Right. Let's start the proceedings. It is my pleasure to introduce the speaker for this lecture, co-organized by the European Institute. Our speaker today is Professor Dr. Georg Milbrandt, whose career, both political and scientific, would take me rather longer than the space allocated to this talk to go through comprehensively. Just a few quick highlights. Professor Milbrandt has been Mr. President of the Free State of Saxony since April the 18th, 2002. Since September 2001, he was chairman of the Christian Democratic Party in the Free State of Saxony. These must be interesting times, incidentally, for any Christian Democrat. Since April 2000, he's also been a member of the National Board of the Christian Democratic Party. He's been Minister of Finance in Saxony, before that City Treasurer of Münster, Westphalia, and he's a lifelong member of the Christian Democratic Party. That's the political side. On the academic side, he's been extraordinary professor at the Department of Economics, University of Münster, since 85. Before that, he taught at the Department of Economics at University of Mainz. He did postdoctoral studies. Before that, he was he got his doctorate, and he studied law and mathematics at the... Ooh, the page drops off. I don't know where I know. But he did it somewhere. My printer obviously let me down here. It's a great pleasure to introduce to you Professor Dr. Georg Milbrandt.
Dear colleagues of the academic world, may I say so, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for your friendly welcome. It is a great honor for me to speak here at this place of leading economic and political research and study. Thank you for the invitation. My contribution today is one from the perspective of an economist turned politician. So my political views are formed by my knowledge of economics, but not totally. This is, at least in Germany, a rare combination. For example, our ministers of finance since 1982 have been a historian, a lawyer, a physicist, and a teacher. The same is true for the ministers of the Department of Economy. These are all very respectable professions, but when we look to our eastern neighbors, we often find that the economic and fiscal policies, they are made by economists, bankers, or businessmen, and that their policies are much better than ours. But it doesn't need the discerning eye of the economist to see the challenge ahead. Prime Minister Blair is a trained lawyer, but he is the one who has called for a reality check of European politics. What is reality? Reality is that since May last year, the European Union is the least homogeneous single market in the world. The prosperity gap is bigger than it has been ever before, and it is bigger than in the United States or NAFTA. I haven't got Chinese figures, maybe it is not true compared to China. Reality is that in the EU nearly 20 million people are unemployed. Reality is that European growth lags behind that of America and Asia. Reality is that in terms of education, research and development, we can't keep stride with America and Asia. Reality is that the EU is failing the people. Finally, reality is that the EU lacks a concept to change this in any favorable way. Rather, it sticks to the old ways. Basically, the EU approach is to sink huge amount of money into the weaker member states in order to bridge the prosperity gap. That's exactly the German approach. It was applied 15 years ago when German reunification took place between the ex-communist economically weak East and the free, economically strong West. This reunification of Germany's own enlargement, to tell you the truth, you won't hear anything about it in the commemorative speeches of today. But the legal procedure was that of an accession of East Germany to the Federal Republic of Germany. The rule of West German law was expanded to the East, with only a few exceptions, where almost all political, economic, social, and educational structures and institutions. The European Union dealt with its new members after a similar fashion. They had thoroughly implemented the so-called acquis communautaire, that is, the extremely voluminous body of EU law, treaties, and regulations. For East Germany, this import of West German laws and institutions was an excellent move in the short run. The people there got tried and tested laws, institutions, and procedures. In short, stability and security. But in the long run, East Germany paid a high price for this form of stability and security, because the laws, institutions, and procedures were designed for an economically powerful, affluent society, not for a former planned economy unfit for global competition, not for a fast-growing economy, which we would like to be. The result was an institutional mismatch that produced huge problems. The East became almost completely deindustrialized, and about a quarter of the workforce was made redundant. More than 80%, 80, of the employees in the old GDR lost their job, and only part of them got a new one. Suddenly, we had within Germany a prosperity gap almost as wide as that between Germany and the Central and East European accession states. And they had a political establishment that wasn't prepared to address this problem by means of completely new economic and social strategies. The bottom line of German economic policy was to sink billions into the economically disadvantaged regions, and nobody was going to change it just because the world has changed around Germany. Of course, one has to concede that the billions in transfer have been very beneficial to us. Saxony, for instance, is now a leading European high-tech region. A fifth of all microprocessors produced worldwide come from Saxony. Meanwhile, Saxony is developing nanotechnology-related research and industry, and we are doing the same for biotechnology. With the exception of the private economy, the East enjoys the same standard of public infrastructure and services. But the success of German economic reunification didn't depend solely on the amount of money spent. The key to the success was competitiveness. And on this count, the government didn't deliver. Proposals to make East Germany a special economic zone were declined. Tax relief was restricted to purchase of real estate in East Germany. An earned income tax credit was out of the question, as was a flat tax, which many former Soviet bloc states in Eastern Europe adopted with remarkable success. Exemptions from West German overregulation were only grudgingly and sparsely granted in order to speed up East German infrastructure development. The rigidly regulated labor market stayed unreformed, apart from a tentative attempt earlier this year. The central barrier to a significant increase in employment still is our special German welfare system. It entitles unemployed persons to a benefit payment which practically defines a wage floor. This creates unemployment, especially for low-skilled workers. The reason? When an employer sticks to this wage floor, the wage he pays to a low-skilled worker, and the taxes and social security contributions, which he has to pay also, tend to be higher than the employee's productivity. On the other hand, the low-skilled unemployed tend to accept job offers only if the net wage is significantly higher than the welfare benefit. As a result, the market for low-skilled work has dried up and an important factor of production remains idle. This barrier to the labor market is especially high in East Germany. Here, welfare benefits are nearly as high as in the West. Productivity, however, is at 70% measures in GDP per employee. The gap is even wider if productivity is measured as GDP per inhabitant or per employable persons. This includes the unemployed, which reaches only to 64% of the West German level. Being as it is, our welfare system produces unemployment. The reason is that welfare is understood in terms of distribution, not allocation. Our system distributes money to the jobless instead of allocating work. In theory, getting our priorities right is quite simple. We just need a paradigm change from wage replacement payments to wage supplements in the low-pay sector. According to a proposal by the economist Hans Werner Sinn, president of IFO, as a result, more than 2 million unemployed could find employment and GDP could grow by an extra 1.9%. Unfortunately, so far, Germany had been denied any such paradigm change, which kept unemployment high and growth low. Moreover, West Germany has to shoulder 4% of GDP in transfers to East Germany, which additionally dampens growth. The truth is that not only East Germany is a transformation economy. The same could be said of West Germany, because the rules of the economic game had been thoroughly changed. The very instance the Berlin Wall came down, globalization set in. The cheapest competitors were no longer thousands of miles away in the Far East, but in our own backyard, less than 20 miles south of my hometown, Dresden. So for small and medium-sized enterprises, it's very easy to go to Poland or to the Czech Republic. It was impossible for them to go to China. That has changed. The advantage East Europeans wanted to get rich as quickly as possible, and they had a huge appetite for a bite of the German market share. Germany could have risen to this challenge by transforming her economy. Instead, the fall of communism was interpreted as a victory of the best of all economic systems, the German social market economy. In sports, the rule is never change a winning team. Consequently, the West German political establishment overwhelmingly believed they didn't need to change the economic policy because it was so successful in the 70s. The failure to recognize the need for transformation in Germany as a whole resulted in sluggish growth and mass unemployment. To put it bluntly, the approach was to alleviate the fate of the unemployed by generous unemployment benefits, which incidentally cost Germany a whopping £50 billion a year, or £75 billion, 750 billion pounds during the past 15 years. Now just imagine we had spent half that amount on wage subsidies, on tax breaks for companies, or research and development. Or we could have taken that money to redesign our welfare system. Germany's biggest problem was, and still is, that welfare is funded by a payroll tax. Income tax and social security contribution add up to about 50% of labor costs, making jobs extremely expensive. Robots and machines were no more productive and didn't have to contribute to social security, so more and more jobs were replaced with them. For an economist, it's quite easy to understand this. For a politician, not. While we tend to be the victims of misguided economic policy, the other Central and East European countries underwent a process of comprehensive market-oriented reforms. For them, competitiveness was a key to foreign direct investment, market shares, and prosperity in the end. Competitiveness meant low wages, flexible labor markets, no frills welfare, a simple tax system, and generally a lean state. Take, for example, Saxony's nearest neighbor, Poland. Poland's GDP per capita adjusted for purchasing power is at 50% of that of Saxony, of the Saxon level, while Polish wages just reach 20% of Saxon level. This is a huge competitive advantage for Poland. Getting so competitive was not a short, easy way to prosperity. It took hard work and many years of moderation to close the prosperity gap this way. But it was successful. For example, Hungary has an unemployment rate of 5.9%, while Germany stands at 9.5% according to OECD figures, and East Germany reaches nearly 20%. As a rule of thumb, the Central and East European countries are now more dynamic and competitive than many an old EU member state, and especially East Germany. The cause of modernization also earns them EU membership. Oddly enough, now that they are in, they are accused of tax dumping, wage dumping, and other sinister plots to ruin the old EU members. Exactly the things to get in shape for the EU, and exactly the things East Germany wasn't allowed because it might end up more competitive than West Germany. We are witnessing a clash of cultures here. The accession countries say we want to close the prosperity gap by winning market shares in Western Europe and worldwide by means of low taxes, a low-cost social security system, and competitive wages. As an afterthought, that's what we should have done in East Germany. However, the old EU members adhere to a different philosophy, with a noticeable exception of the UK, of course. They say, the majority in the EU, we give you, the accession countries, £670 million a year in economic aid, so please refrain from having the better economic and fiscal policy. Don't be overly competitive because it would push us to change our own policies. The case of Germany shows where this philosophy leads. By most economic figures, Germany is falling back. German GDP per capita is well below the EU 15 average and now ranking 11th or 12th of the 15 old EU members. Only Greece, Portugal, Spain, and maybe Italy have a worse performance. Germany is dragging the EU down. Prior to EU enlargement, last year the EU's GDP per capita stood at 72% of the American level. This is not surprising given that Germany accounts for roughly one-third of the GDP in the European Union. The lesson to be learned is that we must abandon the philosophy in which subsidies figure large and competitiveness figures low. This is what Prime Minister Blair has demanded in June this year. In the much noted speech to the European Parliament, he said that competitiveness is the key to prosperity and that the EU must fundamentally change if it wants to keep up with America and Asia. This means that our priority is no longer what the French call espace social, a near harmonization of social and labor standards and in the end of labor costs. Our priority is a competitive, dynamic Europe that creates jobs instead of jobless. This is especially true of Germany. So Mr. Blair could very well have said in his speech, "Dear Germans, please say goodbye to your delusions of grandeur. Get competitive, reform your welfare system, reduce your budget deficit, increase R&D spending, improve your educational system, and get rid of that enormous debt." He didn't say it, but I'm sure he meant it. And he is right, of course. However, as our general election has shown, a majority of Germans doesn't seem to care. During the present political stalemate, it is difficult to produce the kind of leadership necessary to design and act on a grand reform plan. I hope that the problems ahead will force the politician to act. Otherwise, the problems will choose new politicians. At least the way to competitiveness is well known, since German economists have mapped it often enough. First, Germany must redesign her welfare system. So far, it has provided generous insurance against most eventualities of life. So generous, indeed, that a family on unemployment benefit may have a bigger income than a family with one parent working full time with low wages. In future, our welfare system must aim to provide equal chances by way of an excellent education, by first-class training, and by abolishing entry barriers to the labor market. And for many, the highest entry barrier is the level of welfare payments. For employers, especially in the services sector, benefit constitutes a minimum wage, and which often exceeds the workers' productivity. And for low-skilled workers, benefit is higher than a productivity-oriented wage. Consequently, we must help those whose jobs don't earn them enough for a living. We must pay wage supplements, or what the before mentioned Hans van der Zin calls activating social aid benefit. In other words, we should take that 50 billion euros which unemployment costs us so far and spend it on employment, generating a higher output and higher growth, which in turn will create new jobs. Second, new chances to the unemployed mean that we must help companies to create jobs. This means to cut on red tape, to simplify our horribly complicated tax system, and to introduce competitive tax rates. You know that only a few people use the German language internationally, but so far as I have heard, more than 50% of the world literature concerning taxes is still in German. We must only get rid of the habit of making EU directives into German laws that put an extra burden on our companies, while all other member states strictly adhere to the EU guidelines. They are the measures our next chancellor needs to implement. But as I said, the political stalemate will make it more difficult to do so, at least not entirely. My hope is that the EU, led by the UK, not by France, of course, comes to our rescue. That this time it's not Germany shaping the EU, but the EU shaping Germany. Hopefully, Mr. Blair's initiative gathers enough momentum to push the EU and eventually Germany on the path of reform. It would be an irony. 40 years ago, we Germans used to scoff at the British disease. Now it might be the British who cure us from our German disease. Thank you very much for your attention.
Would you be willing to answer some questions?
Thank you very much. Oops. Professor Milblad is willing to answer, to take questions from the audience. So if you raise an arm or maybe a leg, then I will hopefully pick you out and can start. Who wants to open the session? Well, if everybody's going, maybe I'll start. Okay, you go there.
Well, I don't think so. I have the opinion that is the other way around. That the epidemics don't like to be in politics. and that especially economists, academic economists, should be more involved in political themes, not only theoretical projects. And especially in Germany, in the academic circle, there is not a close vicinity to real politics. And maybe that could be the solution. German economists go into policy.
Thank you.
Politics, sorry.
Yes, sir. Much of the ails you have described are German-made, so to speak. Germany is also not part of the euro. To what extent would you say the euro has either added, reinforced, or is benign on the ailments you have described about the German economy? And therefore, in the future, is it really, can we isolate Germany from the wider European construction by the internal market or EMU? Or is it really part of the picture and therefore a European solution is needed? Thank you.
Well, I think the euro has aggravated our problems. I will explain it. Before the euro, we had an advantage in the interest rates. German interest rates were low, whereas in the rest of euro and the eurozone, it was high. And therefore, we had some more power, especially in financing capital. With the EU, we lost this advantage. The second advantage we had, we were a huge economy. And foreign companies came to Germany because they had a huge market. Now, within the EU, it's not longer necessary to be in a huge country to can invest at a place which is in a very small country because you have equal opportunities. And therefore we lost two advantages. And I think that has put burden on us too. The second question is Europe. I think Germany has to change in the eurozone, as well as France and Italy. That are the three big economies in Europe who are not so reform-oriented as the rest. And when the eurozone should be a success, these founding members of the euro had to change. Otherwise, there would be a disadvantage for all in the eurozone. It's not only Germany, it's France as well, and I might say so, Italy as well, too.
Let's go over there first. Yes. Gentlemen, please.
Which institution? The leading economists in our country which are in favor of reform and the business world as well. Our problem is that this is, political speaking, a minority. You have to convince the electorate. You have give them, to win an election, you have give the electorate hope and to have to reduce fear. That is what we have to do. And I might say we were not very successful a fortnight ago. Yes. I tried to. I first said that the new government has to be formed before the 30th of October, because at that time there's a famous event in Saxony in Germany, the inauguration of the Frauenkirche, and I want to know whom to invite. But unfortunately, I think the date of the formation of the government will be a little bit later. I think that you need 3 or 4 weeks at least to find a common platform on which you can do policy for 4 years. As I said, the new coalition, the new government must be successful. Otherwise, the electorate will go to the extreme, to extremist parties, and that would mean more instability in the German political system. Therefore, they have to have success, and therefore, it is better that discussing all problems before the formation of the government, then formate a government very quickly, distribute the jobs, and say, well, the rest can wait. Then we have a very quick solution, but I fear that it will be not a good solution in the long run. Why the middle run? Long run, you cannot say the famous case, in the long run, we are all dead. You know, middle run, medium run. Yes, you are right, but there was a political price paid by Germany for being in the Iraq case on the other side. You know, we had a close alliance with France, which in this form we had never before during the Cold time. There was always a close cooperation with France, but with the rest of Europe, especially Britain and the smaller members, and America as well. So we opted only for France in the west and Russia in the east. But I'm quite sure that will change. Mrs. Merkel is not longer able to go to the sauna with Putin together. Therefore, there will be a change. And I hope there will be a political change as well in the attitudes towards the other European European nations. And personally, I think that was a biggest mistake we made in foreign policy during the last 3-5 years. On the other side, we have to, as you said, we have to think of priorities in Europe too. And priority is not to pay such a huge amount to a sector which in Saxony employs less than 2% and in the European average less than 5% of the working force. We have to pay the money for other objectives in policy. And I hope that in the end there will be some change in the GAP. But at the moment, France is in a good position because they got a decision on GAP up to, I said, 2012 or 2013. So we are fighting an upward battle at the moment, and therefore I fear that it will take some time to alter this policy concerning agriculture. Well, when I'm talking about British, I'm not speaking that they are outside the euro, so, or they should be inside. When I'm talking about Britain, I'm referring to the flexibility of the system. And that's our problem in Europe, in the world as a whole. Developments are very quick at the moment. The years before reunification, the years when the wall and the Iron Curtain existed, was a time when the economy only changes only in slow amounts. It was a slow movement. I think it was true for the technology side as well. After the 80s, we had the reunification of Germany, we had the reunification of Europe, we had a dramatic change in technology concerning especially the use of microprocessors, the new technique in telecommunication, and we had the entry of two large nations into the market, first China and now India. And so the economic situation has changed completely. So what we need is to react to these changes, and the society which is most flexible will be able to get an advantage, because as I said in my lecture, you need changes, but some people are against changes because they think change is a risk, especially when you are rich, you can lose. When you are poor, change is not a risk, it is a chance. So we have to debate reforms in terms of chances, not as we do it nowadays, risks. That is not a positive expression, risk. I think we have to tell the people that by reforming, by changing ourselves, we have an advantage. We can solve our problem, our problems, and we can have growth in Europe as well, economic growth and economic, technical, technological development as well. And we are able in Europe to do this. Look at the European enterprises, or especially the German enterprises. They are able to compete, but unfortunately, not only by factories in Germany. They have products which are competitive. There is no need for restructuring them. What we need is to restructure our society and our political and economic system in Europe, and especially, unfortunately, in my country. Maybe you are right describing the German soul. But on the other side, our political system is risk averse and consensus oriented. Wherever electoral law, which depends on proportional representation. Mrs. Merkel got 35.2 or 0.3% of the popular vote. That is exactly the figure Mr. Blair got in his last election. He has a majority of more than 60 seats in Parliament, so far as I know. And Mrs. Merkel, with the same result, is in the minority. So we have to talk about our electoral system in Germany. This is my opinion. Maybe we are changing this too. The second problem is our peculiar system of federalism. In a normal federal state, each level of government has its own competences. They can decide, they can make expenditures, but they have to pay for this. They have their own resources. The German system is that we have not clearly a clear separation of the different level of government. So in the end, you need the consent or consensus of the federal level and the state level as well. Then, as a prime minister of Saxony, I have to execute federal laws, not only execute it, but pay for them. I want to have a say when the law is passed. So we have to create a real federal system in Germany. That means the separation of the three levels of government, federal, state, and municipal. And the third is business. We have to accept that the role of unions in a globalized world is another one than in the 50s, when you are only doing business in Germany. So we have to reform our business our business decision process as well. But that is my own opinion. It's not part of the political agenda of my party. No, I would like, I must give them. Well, I have to admit that Mr. Schröder was on the right way. The movement was too slowly, and in the end he didn't got the support of his own party. But there were a lot of reform projects in the last years, but these reforms were not enough. That's our problem, and I'm not hopeless. I think Germany is still, as I said, a rich state, a rich society, competitive economy as a whole. And when you come to Germany, the situation is completely different from the years, the pre-Thatcher years. In the 70s in Britain, you really could see what would be the result of policy, of a wrong policy. In Germany, you cannot see the bad results. The trains are running, the public service is in order, the infrastructure is better than in Britain. Nobody has see that there is a real need to act at once. Of course, people know that they have to react, but there's a tendency that the voter says, well, for my lifetime, it's enough. And I dare that Mrs. Thatcher keep away the electoral system would have had a majority if there was not a winter of disbelief or a winter of discontent before. We have no winter of discontent. Nobody is in content. That is our problem, that we are talking not about real problems. Well, 5 million unemployed is a problem, but they get a lot of money. So there is no revolutionary situation in Germany. What we are talking about is our future. And people say, well, you are right, but not so quickly.
The Frisian gentleman in the middle there is.
Sir, I have two questions. The first question is about your position on the accession to the EU or not accession. Your position as an economist, your position as a politician doesn't differ. And the second question is, returning to your remark about Merkel and Putin, do you think we should expect any major change in foreign policy of Germany in that direction?
Well, talking as an economist, I don't see any advantage in the accession of Turkey for the rest of the EU. We are not able at the moment to cope with the inhomogeneity between West and East Europe. And I personally think that it will take a generation or more to solve the problem of the last accession. And therefore, I don't see any sense to begin with another adventure. The only reason to begin another adventure is to keep people's interest away from the failure of the last process. As a politician, I have to add that if you want more than a free trade zone, you must have a European identity. And I cannot see at the moment that it would be possible within the next generation to form a common identity with Turkey and the rest of Europe. I think it is a very difficult job to find an identity without Turkey. And that is on the agenda for the next years or the next decades. I have someone who is living on the border of the old EU, I got some inside information of how an accession process works. And I wonder whether it will be possible to have this process together with Turkey. That is my personal opinion. The only reason why we are talking about the accession of Turkey is to help America. The Americans are in a very good position. Economically, the Europeans are paying, and politically, they have a country supporting them. But I don't see that we need to pay for this American position. And economically, I must put it the other way. A year ago, I was in Washington, and I talked to some people in the State Department, and they said, well, it's a good idea, even economically, to have Turkey inside Europe. Well, I said, I'm against it, but if it is a good idea, I wonder whether there are still border controls at the Mexican-American border. The difference, the economic difference between Mexico and the United States is much more is not so so great, not so big, as a difference between Europe, especially Western Europe, and Turkey. If you compare economic figures, you can see. And nobody in America would say, well, we open the doors, all people from Mexico can come into the United States. It would be impossible for them. And therefore, they don't should tell us otherwise concerning Turkey. Second question I've forgotten. It was
about the Russian Federation and Germany. Do you see any major change?
Russia and
there's
a special relation. Yes, there's a special relation, and there always will be some sort of special relation to Russia because it's our biggest neighbor. It's the biggest market in the East, and we have special interests in Russia. But a special relation to Russia does not mean, in my opinion, no relation to Eastern European state or bad relation to Western West European nation. We have to integrate the policy towards Russia into a concept for Europe as a whole. Of course, we have to think about the future of Poland. We have to think about the future of the Baltic states. And when you think about their future, I think it's not wise to have a common pipeline from Russia through the Baltic Sea directly to Germany. This means, in the end, that the Russians are in a good position concerning the Baltic states and Poland, and especially the Ukraine. They can switch off the supply when the customer Germany is served by another pipeline. So I think that was a big mistake to have a special pipeline directly from Russia to Germany. But as I said, there is hope. Mrs. Merkel will not go to with Mr. Putin to the sauna, and therefore there will be some sort of new relations between Germany and Russia.
Thank you. Well, it's 6 o'clock, and the president has other obligations which were taken away from the building. I'd like to thank him both for his presentation and for the very frank and open and very informative discussion of the incredibly wide range of issues, ranging from Turkey to the sauna. And very few can master all these topics in a space of just over half an hour. I'd like to thank you very much.